afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Sun, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. I'm not going to say I'm excited. As I said last episode, people say, how many times can you be excited? But I'm excited yet again, but I won't say it. Joining me today is a good colleague, friend, a good man, someone I met at Johnson C. Smith when I was an administrator there. And he came in and, man, I tell you, to watch someone who is not only a scholar, but a budding administrator, you kind of know people who are driven that way. You see what they're going to do. He came in, I think he'll correct me if I'm wrong, associate provost, started doing some things. And next thing I know, he's chief of staff. And the next thing I know, he's president. The next thing I know, he's doing all these things. So I'm just so happy for the brother. And he's joining us this week. And ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week my former colleague, friend, Dr. Brian Johnson. Dr. Johnson, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, my friend, and thank you so much. Yeah, that was 2007, and I was glad to say that during that time at John C. Smith, you helped and assisted us in the writing of Dr. Dorothy Cowser Yancey's 14-year history.
Oh, yes.
And I was so appreciative of the work you did there as the CFO, and because personally it was my alma mater, so I was just so very thankful to know that there was someone there who would be doing the right things and would make sure that they're walking in their integrity, and that meant a lot to me. So I thank you for that, and also thank you for your help with the book. And I did see Dr. Yancey's interview with you, and that was so exciting also.
Okay, great, great. Well, listen, man, the feeling is mutual. We did some great work, and I'd like to say the university is better off for it.
Yes.
So today, what we're going to do is have a conversation like I do with all my guests. It's just a conversation. I don't have any pre-planned questions. So the first question that I'll ask you, and as you answer, I'll have derivative questions, and I'll weave into the conversation.
Sure. I know you've done.
So let's just jump right in. So tell us, who is Dr. Brian Johnson, his early years, his family, his grounding, and made him today?
Yeah, you know, they always say you should have pre-planned questions because you get a scholar and a professor, administrator, the president to talk, and they may never shut up. But I'll try to give you the Cliff Notes version. You know, I grew up in inner city Durham in a single parent home, and I was first generation, and I spent a considerable amount of my time sort of walking on the campus of Duke University. And really, that was the place that sort of awakened in me the desire to be on an academic campus. It was very, very profound to me. Most people don't recognize that. But at the time, though, I didn't know the deep gap, if you will, the disparity between a person that would go to Duke and a person who was growing up in the inner city, because my mom was an assistant nurse on that campus. And so I would spend a lot of time on the campus or catching some of the Duke College buses back and forth. But from there, I still took that same desire because my mom's job, she worked at Duke University Hospital, would pay 75% tuition to any private school in the nation. And little did I know at the time, they would have paid also 100% for Duke University had I been focused at that time. And I certainly wasn't. And I used that scholarship to basically go to John C. Smith, as we described. I entered into in the fall of 1991 at John C. Smith University. Dr. Yancey was there during my senior year, but it really was a place. It was a small liberal arts college. I knew that I went in wanting to be a teacher. All calling, I believe, is progressive. I started wanting to be a teacher. I was in the honors college, and then they said, you could be a professor. And then I was like, wait a minute, you don't just have to teach. You can be a scholar and write books. And wait a minute, you don't have to be a scholar and write books. You could be an administrator. And wait a minute, you could be a president. And it's all these things, including sitting with Dr. Yancey as a senior after I led student rallies and just all of it. And so in many ways, John C. Smith from 1991 to 95 was it really got a glimpse of the progressiveness of what I had been called to. And I believe that all of those experiences culminated into becoming a university president. After that, I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and got a master's degree in English in 1998. And then I came home and got married to my wife, college sweetheart, Shamika Barnes-Johnson. I was a senior in the Honors College, and I recall giving her a tour of the campus, and that was when we met. I've had two boys since then. I completed my degree 1999 to 2003 at the University of South Carolina, Columbia. Was fortunate to be the first African-American to receive a degree in literature from that school. The first African-American was a woman. She had a creative writing degree. And then there was a second African-American. It was composition. But, you know, I wanted to flow with ideas. You know, I believed in, you know, I'm gifted enough to not just be an African-American studies history person. I love African-American studies. That was my minor. I love African-American history, and I delved into it. But I wanted to understand 17th to 19th century American writers. I wanted to understand those thinkers, you know, religion and the politics and the Enlightenment thinkers and the transcendentalists and the founders of the country, because I felt like there was a lot in there. And after I left, got my PhD in 2003, I began my academic career at a small school. You know, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, but its academic sister is Gordon College, which is a Christian university in Wenham, Massachusetts. And I was there from 2003 to about 2007. And so long story short, I'm back at a Christian institution here at Warner Pacific University, in part because, you know, my whole journey was one that was, if you will, a wedding of my personal faith, my convictions as a person. You know, I talk a lot about the fact that, you know, it's about character and it's about credentials and competence, in addition to a desire to do something. You know, the individuals say, I'm called to be a CFO like Gerald. Okay, well, let's, first of all, do you have that identity and that consistency in your character? And do you have the credentials to do it? And beyond that, the eventual mastery of that. And of course, the mastery through competence comes through the experiences you've had, experiences I've had, and you eventually keep growing into that perfect day. And so that's just in a nutshell where I was. And obviously the rest is history. I left Gordon College, and I went briefly to Claflin University. You may not know that. And that's where, I started an institute there. And Dr. Yancey recruited me to come back as the Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs during her transition. And then as she retired, then the incoming president asked me, you may not know, Gerald, but I was the only one that I think that I was the only time that was the only time when Dr. Carter and Dr. Yancey met was in my presence. I believe I was kind of the buffer between the two, in the sense of, you know, having that initial, their first initial conversation. I think it was their only conversation. And I tell people that story, like, here's this young administrator, you know, coming at the heels of a 14-year presidency and then a new presidency that would last 10 years. And I was there, you know, at their first meeting, just sort of standing and watching. And I'm like, it was just tremendous. And I realized that after that time, it would prepare me for where I would have to go. Left there in 2008 and 2010. And then that's where I went to Austin Peay State. I remember seeing you on campus when I was checking out in 2010 to 2014, where really a 10,000 plus institution, regional, very diverse. I'm big on being at diverse institutions and was there as an assistant provost, eventually became a vice president of strategic planning there, and ran accreditation, ran diversity, participated in a number of presidential preparation programs, the ACE, the ASCU MLI, just almost anything I could get my hands on, including senior leadership for Christian colleges and universities, where I've always maintained a lot of colleagues and connections. And then 2014, I got the call, the unanimous call to be the president of Tuskegee University. And obviously, those 3 years were some of the greatest in my life, in the sense that I was able to learn very deeply about universities and boards and fundraising. And, you know, I saw it all, and literally the good, the bad, the ugly. And and was made the better for it in many ways. And so I left there in 2017. And then I took a year off and I eventually joined my former president, who was my president at Austin Peay State at Mercy College. And I launched a new campus in 2018, right in the heart of Manhattan. The Manhattan campus of Mercy College had about 1,000 students there, small. It was sort of like, you know, this is what I'm looking for, you know, somewhere where I can make impact, somewhere where students can truly be developed, even as I was developed in college directly, you know, not just meeting superstars from afar, but having those people sit down and share their stories. All the people I brought to Tuskegee were people, some of which I've grew up with. Dr. Yancey introduced me to Cornel West as a senior, and here I am, you know, bringing him to meet our students. And so that was very important to me. And when I began to say that, you know, I'm called to be a president and I don't know how this is going to work out, because as you're aware, a lot of times in the HBCU space, people can go into those presidencies and not have an iota of issue with anything in terms of reputation, but because of sometimes the conditions of the institution, you know, the president's got to take it all, whether you did it or not. Yeah. Look, whether you were responsible, like, wait a minute, don't you know these issues predated 2014? Oh no, you're the one who So when I was looking for a university, I said, no, I know I'm a university president, and really had to, be willing to step back into the saddle, and had a lot of colleagues like, no, listen, you're a university president. And this opportunity came about in 2000, I left Mercy during the pandemic in 2020. And came out to Portland, Oregon. And this is a small Christian / very progressive, though, very progressive, diverse, metropolitan, cosmopolitan in thinking. So there's, you know, it doesn't have a position on the right or the left. That's how I am. You know, I don't want to be in a Republican box. I'm not in a Democratic box. I'm not in a Black box. I'm not in a white box. I'm organically and authentically the person that God has called me to be, and that has different manifestations depending on what I'm doing at the time. And so I can just say, like you said, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying board support. I'm enjoying a group of people who's ready to get rolling. I've learned patience and timing, and just, you know, just really, really, really excited about what we can do here. To continue to grow the institution. The institution is about 800 students, about half of which are undergrad students. The other half are professional and graduate students. And so we have a real big opportunity here and some things that we're anxious to try out. So I'm really looking forward to this year.
Well, you know what, Dr. Johnson, you just did something. You're the first guest to do this, but you rattled off your entire career to this point. I want to do with you like I did every game. I was watching your body language as you spoke.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I saw the gleam in your eye and everything else. You're called to do this work.
Yes.
But this started somewhere. And
yes.
It started out by talking about your mom being a nurse on the Duke campus.
Yeah.
And you don't just get on a path that you have journeyed and still are blazing without a grounding.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about the Johnson household that grounded you such that you saw yourself as a scholar. I consider you a go-getter. That started somewhere. So what was the Johnson household like?
Hey, man, you know, we didn't have little, but we had the Lord. And that's just to be honest. You know, I always talk you know, my mom read the Bible endlessly. And growing up, I never knew what that was all about. Praying, you know, she worked hard, didn't have enough energy really to do a lot other than to come home and to pray and to read the Bible. And you know, I didn't come into my faith in the Lord until the fall of my senior year, 1994. But all of those things, I believe, were being placed in me. The fact that she read the Bible, you know, you may not know, I do a lot of quotes and I read a lot and I've wrote about a lot, but my most important pastime and hobby has always been the Bible. Like it's something that's in me, and it's principles. The, you know, one of the scriptures talks about, you know, you know, there's going to come an end to human knowledge, but thy word is exceeding broad. In other words, there's nothing deeper than the Bible. Like there's nothing, the principles, the, and so I realized, you know, wow, that's where your facility with ideas have come. That's what your facility with moving in different spaces, because really that rooted it and that groundedness in your personal faith. And then once you have that, of course, like all persons who have faith, you know, you go through trials, and yet you understand that those trials are not designed to harm you. They're designed to perfect you, right? Like, you know, you don't all of a sudden get up and get excited like, oh man, you know, this is what I'm called to do. Okay, you're called to do it, but I'm going to make you perfect in it. And perfect is all about maturity, you know, learning, you know, I was very immature administrator at John C. Smith and growing at Austin Peay, growing still at Tuskegee, I'm still growing. And one of the beautiful things that I look back at and I understand and my personal relationship with God and my personal understanding of the Bible is that's the way he worked with every single person in the Bible, you know, to bring them to a point of maturation in spite of their issues and their flaws and their immaturities and until you get to that perfect day. So I just realized, wow, you know, your journey is continuous. So I'm glad that you talk about the foundation. The foundation of my calling is Christ. And from that emerges the journey, as it were, the journey to come to understand him more and to accept what he does. And ultimately, when that becomes your purpose and your focus, then all these other things just start falling into place. And then you're like, wow, I look back at that experience and wow, you know, I don't smell a singe on me. In fact, I'm better. But you know, many of us don't want to go through that part of our faith. We have a convenient faith. You know, we don't have the kind of faith that's willing to go through suffering. You know, we don't want to step out.
Nobody wants to suffer.
You know, nope. You know, I tell my students all the time, if you learn how to suffer, you'll learn how to succeed, because you'll realize that in every challenge in your career and in your life, it's designed. It's not a failure. It's designed for you to get a lesson to make you better for the next place. So if you ever want to get to the next place, then that means likely you're going to experience a failure or a lesson that you probably don't want to. But in the end, it's going to be a benefit. But yeah, make no mistake about it. I believe in Christ as the author and the finisher of my faith. And it's so personal to me. It's not something I go out and talk about. I know you're a brother and in the faith, and because I don't want to be seen as, you know, trying to use faith as a thing to do, you know, that it's my very life. It's my very heartbeat. And what I do is for me, drawing people to him is the way in which I believe you have to do it in your way. You know, you know, you got thinkers and scholars, they're interested in quotes, students are interested in music, some people, and all of these things are manifestation of who he is and mm-hmm. in so many different ways. So I appreciate that question, because most people don't come straight out and ask it, but if you ask me, I got to tell you that it's rooted and grounded in my faith in the Lord.
Well said, my brother. But you know, I've always been intrigued by something, literature. Mm. You are a Du Bois scholar, and you know, that whole interplay between Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. Yeah. You spend a whole lot of time in that space. So coming up through your foundation and middle school, high school, was this literature thing always with you, or did you just develop a passion for it once you got to, say, Johnson C. Smith? Was it the
Or
how did that happen?
Well, you know, one thing my eighth grade teacher always told me is once gifted, always gifted. You know, I was brought up in gifted and talented programs, but in the inner city, you know, growing up where I was growing up, nobody, you know, you're not supposed to go be smart and stay in the academically gifted classes or the gifted and talented classes. You know, on my personal website right now, I have a, I was in the first ever performance of The Color Purple as a 13-year-old playing Albert Johnson. We have the full video on my website. And
really?
I was just talking with someone about, they were like, you know, you were always gifted. And this is before I even knew the Lord. And I just could pick up on things. I could read something and understand it, spelling, words. That was just my gift. It's not everybody's gift, but I, you know, I know what the grace of a gift is. You with numbers and doing what you do, I'm like, I don't, you know, I got to get a good CFO, which, by the way, I did name my CFO an executive VP, thinking of you. But everybody has their own lane, their own giftings and callings. And so I think when I knew I wanted to be a teacher, it's like, well, this thing got to be in English because I'm good with words. I'm good with writing and I'm good with understanding some complex ideas. And I just knew that I wanted to be an eighth grade teacher. Right. And then that's where when I got to school and then I ran into the Honors College program director, like, wait a minute, you can be an English teacher, but I don't want you to stop there. Go be a college professor. I didn't know, Gerald, anything about college professors and how they got there and what they did. And then I got into the Mellon program and Dr. Yancey and you know, bringing those resources and things. And then you're going around and you're going around with other smart kids from Harvard and Spelman and Morehouse. Stacey Abrams was in one of the programs I was in. Just
really?
So wow. Many names of people Yeah. And so I was in those same spaces, but yet, honestly, you spend a lot of time, you know, you battle insecurity. You know, I believe you battle insecurity all your life, really, until you really get to the point of arriving at who he's called you to be. And that's where I'm at now. But during that time, it was like, well, wait a minute, I want to be, but I'm not at a big school. I'm not at Harvard. And I'm not, you know, I want to be, I feel like I can do all those things. But I think knowing intuitively, and I think we all know that there are some things that you naturally gravitate towards that just came to you, no one can take credit. And I do believe that's the God and where he begins in you. And then from that moment on, like I said, he started leading you into the identity phase. I think character is not just about integrity pieces, but it's about really identity. Like, you got to come to know who you are, right? Like, you got to come to know it and understand it. And as you come to know it, and I've learned it, you know, and looking at the life of Moses, this guy had to eventually recognize at one point, right? Like, he had to eventually recognize, like, wait a minute, I'm a Hebrew, but I'm living over here with the Egyptians. And hold up, like, am I Egyptian or am I? So those stories help me to understand, like, wait a minute, you're neither. And then, you know, he jumps out. Well, maybe I'm supposed to save these people. They look at him like, boy, you ain't supposed to save us. You know, you can't, you gonna kill us like you killed the Egyptians. Like, wait a minute, I thought I was. Yeah, so the character piece, but, and then, you know, understanding his credentials, right? Like, you know, I'm gonna be able to, you know, when God eventually uses him to do it in the way he wanted to do it, you know, I'm gonna use your knowledge of the desert. I'm gonna use your knowledge of Egyptians. I'm gonna use all of these things. And then ultimately, you know, confidence comes from mastery, you know, through his failures and things. And so I relate the story of Moses because for me, knowing that intuitively I had some things, but knew that I wouldn't get the understanding of those things without, you know, experience and without confirmation. Like, you know, you tell me that you are a singer, somebody at some point ought to be able to say you can actually sing too, right? Like, and so, you know, calling Gerald has been always a big thing. Like, that's the one thing. I'm going to a conference. I'm a keynote speaker in Denver, and I hope to post it on the video where I'm going to share a lot of these same things. It's ironic you're talking about, because I've never truly been able to talk about calling from the standpoint of how I understand it. And I think it's the most important thing in the world for people to come to know who you are and what you're called to be, and that it's like never too early or never too late. And once you get to and arrive at the place that you're called to be and you finally accept it, Gerald, it's the greatest time in your life. And it's just, that's just where I'm at now. And that's where I'm hoping to continue to stay.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because you're a college university president, and you're just describing the twists and turns that your career took, the lessons learned. You know, I tell people all the time, We write our stuff in pen in ink. We need to start writing our stuff in pencil because, you know, God will erase it and put something else.
Yes.
And when you think about young people today, and you said you had about 800 or so young people that you're responsible for because you are a president. Do you get the sense that what you just described, that they understand that in context, or is it part of the journey that you're responsible for teasing that out of them? Is that?
Yeah, that's a good. See, a little bit about that. I think that's the whole understanding of what education is. You know, John Dewey, who's, you know, sort of the father of, you know, liberalism, and he described the university environment, and he said the university should be a place where children and students go into all kinds of rooms. Don't be, if you're a Christian or if you're a Muslim, you can go into any room, go into a Muslim room, go into, you need to experience as much as possible. That is the value of higher education. In the 19th century, that was where the formation of course, Harvard was founded to train ministers, and so was Yale. But even in that, it was still designed to say, okay, you guys want to make ministry a profession, but you need to be exposed to the sciences and to the natural order of things. And I believe that's essentially what a college university does and should be doing. If you're not in the business of holistically developing a student, a person, then you're in the wrong business. And I think that is the purpose of a university education. Not so much the degree, it helps, it gives the credential, but it really, I think, helps to help shape and crystallize the call in individuals' lives. And that might happen in a dorm room conversation with their roommate, but we've provided the space, a great space for them to do that. Or it might happen in a lecture where their eyes are awakened to Cornell West, or might through the professor, or through the fraternity experience if they have one, or through relationships as they try out different things in life. It's like a miniature world, and you know how it is in college. You know, it's not the real world. So, you know, my son's getting ready to go to college, but in those 4 years, you're still not in the real world yet, even though you're away from home. Mm-hmm. But all of that is really what the purpose of the university education it should be. And that's why I'm increasingly convinced that the focus on, again, the career and the credentials without understanding the calling, you know, careers will fill your pockets, Gerald. A calling will fulfill you as a person. But you link a career with a calling, you're going to fulfill a great purpose, because the work you're going to be doing won't be considered a job. You know, you'll do it day and night, and you'll earn enough money for your family and to support others. But more importantly, you're going to have a purpose that's going to impact people. Yeah. And so as students come to learn that, I do think that's one of the most important pieces to the development of young people these days. And I'm all for entrepreneurship. I'm all for people saying school is too important, too expensive. I understand those things, but really it's 4 more years of growth. And in fact, W.E. Du Bois talked a lot about, and it's really an ancient principle that, you know, really manhood shouldn't begin until you're 30, age 30, because you need time to grow. You know, pushing a kid out the house at 17, he ain't ready, or even 21, 22, go to grad school if you can. Trust me, as you know, you got plenty of years to work, right? Get as much learning and training about yourself so that when you're prepared to go out into the world as an arrow shot forth, you have as much as you can, even though you know you're still going to be learning more on that journey. But yeah, Gerald, I think that's the most important piece of the university education. That's what I've always done at Tuskegee here, you know, bringing in speakers. I'm going to bring you in. I'm going to bring in different people to share different aspects of their lives and hopeful, and to spend time with me. I've always opened the door to my home and sit around the fire pit, sit around the, you know, ask Dr. Johnson. My wife and I used to do these Sunday night chats, and they was almost shocked that we were willing to share, you know, what, you know, our relationship. Like, wait a minute, well, you guys are supposed to be the president. I'm like, no, I want you to understand and learn from our lives. And that's really the goal of an education. You know, you don't have to go through everything by yourself. You can sit and learn and to have conversation. And so for me, I think that's really, if I had to describe what is education, is just what you asked me, helping people to come to understand their calling and their purpose and providing a place for that.
What you're describing actually though is mentorship.
You're right.
If you can go back and try to capture mentors that have sustained you on this journey and this path, because this podcast is about inspiring people. It's not rocket science, right?
Yeah.
It's really just hearing these authentic stories. Now, what you just said was amazing to me, because the students were shocked that you and Mrs. Johnson would share so openly about your journey, but that's really mentorship. So who would you point to?
I love that you asked that, because for me, not only historic figures I read about, but the people I lived with and experienced, and I'll give some of those names, and then people who are alive that I never met, but yet they were a mentor in a certain way. So, you know, as a professor, as a teacher, you know, my eighth grade middle school teacher who taught the gifted classes and who understood, you know, from that standpoint, what it was to be a teacher. He was my first Black male teacher. He inspired me to want to be a teacher, right? But then when it comes to being professors, there were people like Lisa Delpit or college professors who, when you saw them teach, it's like, that's just, like you said, it's just flowing out of them. Or then you read about teachers, great teachers. You know, you read about the great Charles Spurgeon and how he spoke his sermons. But when you read his sermons, you realize, wow, this guy's a teacher. Then on the scholarship side, yes, I've read about W.E.B. Du Bois. I don't know W.E.B. Du Bois, but he was a mentor to me. The way in which he could, he was such a prolific scholar. I was nowhere near what he did, but he was a model in that sense. Cornel West was a model in terms of a modern day person. And even though he wasn't in my life, he could help assist me and mentor me. Men like Os Guinness, C.S. Lewis, these were scholars that I admired, but I admired from afar. And in some ways, even though I didn't know Cornel West as I was coming to be a scholar, I could read his scholarship and I could read like, okay, that is my writing style. You know, and then as administrator, I think we both share going into really more presidency was Dr. Yancey, because, that mentor who had to go into an environment that was challenging, but all the skill sets she had as a professor, as a scholar, came to bear on helping our university, because she had to, you know, money and mechanics. She had to know, be able to think on her feet. She had to be able to go and give a speech on the drop of a dime. And that's in my personal life. But then there's Booker T. Washington. So most people don't know, you know, I'm a Du Bois scholar, but I'm a Booker T. Washington man. Like, that's who I am. Like, I'm not a Du Bois. I love Du Bois. I can bring value out of it. That's why people couldn't understand, well, hold up, you're supposed to be Washington or Du Bois. They said, no, that's the way people have taught you to think about both of them. In fact, both of them co-wrote a book together, and people don't even look at the linkages. They talked about some of the same things. And so for me, I don't look to any other president historically than a Booker T. Washington, because nothing he's done has ever been matched by any person, race, Black, white, or whatever. And so for me, mentorship comes from pulling pieces. And then even beyond that, I pull from your life. I've watched you and your family. I think mentorship can be from afar, but most time people, limit themselves because, I love Dr. Yancey, and it's like, but wait a minute, I want to get a mentor who can understand this aspect of me too, and this aspect. So I can't create one person to fit all the different aspects, because you know what I mean? They may not have children. I have children, or they may not have this. And so for me, it's like pulling mentorship from people. And you do that, I think, through conversation and deep listening to them. And if they've written, reading their books and trying to pull what principles apply to you to be helpful for your particular journey. And I just think you just kind of know that, but you're right. It's all about mentorship. And I know you get it all the time. I get it all the time. You're amazed when people like, oh, I look at you as a mentor, because it means that they are gleaning something from your life that has been so impactful that they've added it to who they are. But I always try to caution that it's not, you don't have to limit your mentors. You could have mentors seen and unseen, but it's better to be able to talk to some of them so you can ask them some questions, which I certainly did with a lot of my mentors.
Now, you know, what's interesting to me, and this is why I'm enjoying this conversation.
Yep.
Yeah, I know you. I know some of what you did, but I'm learning a lot about you today.
Yep.
But one of the things that's interesting to me is we live in a very, very fast-paced social media world.
Yeah.
And to hear what you just said is interesting because we don't talk about the failures.
Yeah.
We only talk about the successes, or we talk about the things that are leading to success.
Yeah. Yes.
But the best teachers that you could have is when you have to find that mentor, or what I call a kitchen cabinet of mentors.
Yes.
Can walk you through your failures, right?
Yes.
And get you back to where you need to be. So when you think about it in that light, how do you go about finding a mentor that could be such that to help you through those tough times? Because I get the sense sometimes social media gives the impression everything is hunky-dory.
Everything
hunky-dory. And we should never, ever fail or fall That's short right. on anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I don't think social media is the place to really try to do anything that's of deep substance. That's just the beginning. Even if a person says, oh, you know, I failed, but I'm going to get right back up. People be complaining. Yeah, you're getting right back up. But no, you might not get right back up that quick. So social media is so instant gratification. And I don't think any deep mentoring happens that way. Deep mentoring happens through relationship too, right? Like the mentor that picks up the phone and know what you went through and picks up the phone and call, and maybe don't have all the answers, or maybe doesn't want to just come in and judge and say, oh, well, you shouldn't have done this or you shouldn't. But that's relationship, Gerald. I think that's why as you pursue your purpose and your calling, you have to have key people, strategic people that's going to be with you regardless of whether you are Du Bois scholar, president of this school, or anybody who knows. And like you said, you know, you're like, wow, I'm learning who Brian Johnson is. There are people who know who I am, you know, my good friend, good people, strategic people who know deeply some aspect of either my faith or what I want to do in my scholarship, my goals as a university president, people who know that aspect of me. And like I said, it's not always one person. But in some cases, when you do go through a failure and it seems like all of it implodes, you need all of those people that, you know, that came up with you, didn't come up with you through social media. You know, social media, I don't regard it as anything because they're just waiting on something to celebrate. And I've been there, done that, got the t-shirt when everybody's celebrating you. And then when if you go through a kind of public divorce like we did at Tuskegee, and it's like, wait a minute, nobody reaches out then, right? Like, and it's like, wait a minute, not that I was ever into that anyway, because I didn't connect with people like that. But I understood that that is how social media is and how, frankly, the world is. You know, only people want to be around you when you are successful. So you have to really have deep and meaningful friendships beyond social media, because you can't see it in social media. Meaning, if I can't pick up the phone and talk and conversate about this or about that, and those are the people before you get to where you're gonna go, or before you fail, those are the people you need to come back. The people who can remind you of who you are. You know, I got friends from where I grew up in inner city who remind me, like, look, we know who you are. We so proud of you from the hometown, because that reminds you, like, wait a minute, I didn't just stumble my way up to the presidency of Tuskegee, right? Like, I ain't just, wait a minute. And then your friends from college, you know, people that know you deeply. Like, I know this is your heart. I know that who you are. So that's the best way. So how do you find them? I think you create them and they're there alongside your journey, but perhaps you haven't brought them into the new space you're in, right? Like, I've always tried to be so, whether I'm a president of Austin Peay or Tuskegee or Warner Pacific, you know, I want people who knew me in whatever light you knew me to know that I'm still that person. Now, you may be afraid to reach out or whatever, but you hit me an inbox. I want to be to say, hey, BJ, man, you remember we used to go hang out? Yeah, I remember we used to hang out in the creek. Yeah, and like, man, that was so fun. And then that reminds me, like, man, I like to laugh and I like to have jokes. And people don't understand, like, man, I don't look at it as, oh, you're the president. I can't talk to you. Or, you know, your fraternity brothers who you go out with and, you know, you hang out and, you know, smoke a cigar with. Yeah, I enjoy smoking a cigar. Like, wait a minute. Wow. You're not supposed to know. These people know who I am. So, and the same thing with my faith, like, most importantly, like, You know, I may be telling you and announcing to whoever, but anybody who truly knows me know that I'm all about my faith in the Lord, and I'm all about the Bible. And that is not, it's a deeply personal one. And like, for me, I don't go about trying to proselytize anybody to believe what they want to believe. But if you ask me how I've gotten to where I've gotten, I just got to tell you. Yeah, and so for me, those people who know that about you and respect that about you, those are your mentors, and you gotta, and I've learned that you gotta keep them the closest, and be open and willing, and also make the invitation for them to say, hey, you can reach out. My door is always open for you to speak into my life or to say something to me that perhaps I don't want to hear, because I trust that you know me authentically. So I think it's all about knowing, having people around you who know you as you are and know you who you desire to be. And I think that's the best way in terms of choosing a mentor, grounding it in a real relationship. And oftentimes you'll find that's been there all your life. You might not have just tapped into it, though.
But, you know, it's interesting because I've watched you from a distance and I've known this about you for some time. Yeah. Since we both left Johnson C. Smith, I started to realize that your fraternity brothers, your line brothers, mm-hmm. you guys find a way to always get together. I said, well, wait a minute. Isn't he living in Portland? I mean, the Johnson brothers, you know, no priest. Yep. And I'm like, but they live in Charlotte.
Yeah.
And so how is he doing this? So tell us a little bit about those relationships, because those are key, I would imagine, to keep you grounded, especially. Yeah. Once you get big for your britches, they pull you back down.
Oh, man, that's exactly, you know, Damien, Ed Brown, who was my chief of staff at Tuskegee, who's now going on to be the chief of staff at Wisconsin-Madison in the diversity division. Now he's at Denver Metropolitan College. Taz Ware, who's in real estate. All of those brothers, man, we've pushed each other because, we've seen each other in our most vulnerable spaces, right? Like online, you know, I can tell you when you become a public figure of any sorts, the first thing people try to do is to find out about you. But, you know, not my circle. First of all, you're not going to tap in the few guards in inner city Durham, because anybody look at you crazy, you're not going to talk about BJ, not to me. Then you're not going to go to my fraternity, my line brother, you're not going to go to them and be like, well, you know, I think he arrogant. Get out of here, because he was like this. We were, you know, Damien trying to be a entrepreneur in business. We would share those dreams with each other. Just our conversations were long and deep and college and late into the night. Like, that was our whole existence. Like, and as you know, you grow and you develop your families, you have to make that time for that. You know, the Zoom meetings, or, you know, during the pandemic, if you could have a strategic placement of where you could all be, you got to make sure you make that happen, because that's important. You know, my home is in South Carolina. That's my home base. Look, I learned that from Dr. Yancey. Always have a home to go to when you're a university president. Right. I always did. Yeah. The same way in Tuskegee, living in the mansion. Yeah, but I got a home to go to. You see, I learned that through a minute. You know, I learned that from Dr. Yancey. But it's important to know, you know, where your roots are. But in that particular case, my Lon brothers, and the other thing about that, Gerald, is that we all came into the faith in the same time period, and our own understanding of what faith is. And some of us have, had different evolutions of that. But at the core is that we love each other no matter where we are in that space. You know, some people are like, man, you know, I'm not into the church thing anymore. I'm not into this anymore. Okay, that's good, but I still love on you and for who you are and what you expressed as you came into those things, because you know, anybody who knows anybody who is trying to learn anything about God is that, you know, God can do with that person what you can't do or touch with them. And it's nothing about you trying to shape someone's belief or where they are. And what you really need is the permission to be who you are in whatever state you are in your career. You know, and, you know, that's friendship, and that's who they are. I can come in as the president. I can come in as not a president. I can come in as this or that, and I'm still BJ to them. Yeah, yeah. And that is more important than anything in the world. And, you know, it's really helpful because, you know, you can kind of identify, you know, it's okay, you know, call Dr. Johnson formal places because they don't work with me in formal places. And they would call me Dr. Johnson or President Johnson. But there's nothing refreshing than to hear someone, you even call me Brian or BJ, and some who know me as BJ, because I know immediately when a person calls me that you're not used to calling me. You can't even say Brian because you know me as Dr. Johnson. Or you know, if somebody say BJ, it's like, okay, I know where you come from. But I think that's important. And too often we don't take advantage of that. Like, you know, you get into a certain space and now you interact with everybody of a different culture. And like, no, you don't want to share. I went through that struggle. Like, okay, what role do these men have in my life now that I'm trying to be here? Or what role does my background in the inner city have in my life being here? You know, for a while, I mean, even between Black people, you know, Black people are kind of hard on us too, you know, want you to be ashamed of growing up in inner city Durham. I'm telling you, Gerald, it's that deep. Like, and I know you from your background and your roots in Jamaica, but I always did not like that about certain aspects of our community, making you wanting you to be ashamed of being. We talk about being first generation, but when it's right in front of your face, you know, then they accuse you of not having the same credentials as Barack Obama. I'm like, wait a minute, I ain't Barack Obama, but I'm doing the very best I can with what I have. And so because of that, when you get on such a pedestal and you get those kind of knocks, like, you got to go back like, no. Who are the people that know you're not trying to be like that. You're trying to be the best you can be. And I would say those friendships are the most important that I have. And that's where I like to have my conversations.
Well, I'm looking at you and I'm, you know, listening to this conversation. And I can tell you, I see a man at peace. I see a man who went through some stuff, and I see a man who has bounced back in a really, really big way. Yeah. I see a father who has two sons who dotes on his son, who is a monster on the football field. But talk to me a little bit about that. I'm gonna be formal with you. Is Dr. Brian Johnson now at peace with all that he has gone through?
Oh yeah.
Family, everything else.
Man, I'm at super peace, but it's not. But Gerald, here's the funny thing. You ain't seen nothing yet, bro.
Oh, wow.
It's just like, you ain't seen nothing yet. Like, it's like now I feel like I can manage it and I understand it. Like, it's just beginning, to be honest. Like, it's like, okay, now, okay, you thought that was something. Wait to what you start walking in. And, you know, you'll start hearing of some things that, you know, maybe at Tuskegee, I was trying to give everybody what it is. Now I learned that, no, you don't need to throw it out there. You don't need to cast your pearls before swine. Just let it grow. Let it develop. Let people see in their own space, maybe not even on your own page. But as far as peace and fatherhood, you know, so first of all, for me, I had to learn. I always wanted a father, you know, who could provide for me, you know, who could protect, you know, my father, you know, he was married to my mom up until I was 13, but he was really, you know, he's in and out of the home. So it really was like a single parent. And growing up where there are gangs and growing up where you have a single parent mom who's trying to provide, like, you know, not having resources, I always wanted to be like, oh man, or if there's a bully in the neighborhood, I didn't have a big family. So I'm like, where's my dad? I need somebody to protect me. So that was my whole relationship to wanting to be and provide and have resources for my son. But even in that, I had to grow because, Gerald, you know, the things I wanted and needed are not necessarily what they needed and wanted. In other words, they don't know what it's like not to grow up in a home. Or, you know, these boys are living in mansions as a boy, you know, in Tuskegee. Like, they were living in walking in history, like, as children. So, you know, okay, sending them a Cash App, not really what they need. Or, you know, their experiences have been different. They grew up around Michelle Obama and Tyler Perry, you know, it was, that was their experience. Your experience wasn't like that. So because of that, they're going to need a different kind of fatherhood. And so then I had to learn, like, wait a minute, you know, they don't have to have that rough and tough, you know, go get them like I had to go. You know, I had to get everything I got. Like, I had to get on my own. Like, if I don't get it, it's not going to come. But that, because they had a different experience, I had to say, now, wait a minute. You know, I personally, you talk about football, I celebrate it, but I personally don't want them to be, play football.
Really?
But that's, yeah, man, football, what you going to do? Career, end 33, 30, I mean, what? I mean, you know, how many, listen, I got football players in my neighborhood, former football players. I mean, you can't, but I'm not, but again, I can't push my dream on him. If that's his dream, it's like, I'm going to still celebrate him. I'm going to help support him. But, you know, it's like, okay, but, you know I'm going to come in there at the right decision time. You know, I'm not just going to let you go to any school to play football that's not also going to help with your intellectual, spiritual, right, emotional development. Right. And then I'm also not going to push you into a school that I wanted to be at. And just so, you know, you can experience a certain kind of success that I can be proud of. I want you to find the right rhythm for you in your life and your unique calling. And so I had to really step back and say, wait a minute, make sure that I'm celebrating what he wants to come and to come in when I need to come in and when I'm invited in. And so, yeah, I had to really grow with that. But the peacefulness obviously starts with your family and saying, wait a minute, you know, any career, any job I've had, I was always the same person to them. And that's most amazing. Like, wait a minute, they don't even know. Like, okay, yeah, people tell me you were the president or whatever, but I didn't know. I'm just going through life. So that nothing humbles you like your own children and explaining to you who you think you are. But I will say, as far as, like I said, being at peace, you know, I love the works of Parker Palmer, and one of his books is To Know As We Are Known. And there's one that chapter that's described as the divided self and how we can't live divided anymore. And so what tends to happen is you try to live for what people think you want you to be, and you're trying to live for this group and that group, and you're just divided because you're all these trying to be these different things. Now, again, it doesn't mean that you know, at different times you can't do this and that and the other, but you don't have to live there. You know what I mean? Like, like the classrooms that, look, I can go visit this Middle Eastern classroom doctrine and philosophy, and I love it and it's great, but I don't have to live there. I don't have to live in any one room and my experiences. And so when you get to the point where you realize that an experience is an experience and a lesson is a lesson, that doesn't necessarily mean it's at the core of who you are and your identity. And that takes growth in knowing the value of meditation, the value of prayer, which, you know, you can get too busy and you just all off. And I had to get back to some of the things before I came to Tuskegee. You know, I didn't really want to be a president at an HBCU, to be honest. I was in schools like I'm at now. I was the finalist at like three or four different schools. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm going through the interview process and like Tuskegee sped up. Now I understand why I had to go to Tuskegee for that experience. But I realized when it was all over and I'm like, oh, I'm going through this. Really, at the end of the day, I was like, you really weren't ever happy there anyway. You wanted to be somewhere where you can talk and be the way you are, where, you know, you can go talk to churches or you can go give a lecture or you can go to a community event and you would be the same, and it wouldn't be as if, oh, you can't talk about Christianity or your faith, you can't talk about Du Bois in Washington, or you can't talk about Ralph Waldo Emerson. No, I want to be where I can talk about all those things. No, I'm not in a woke box. So no, I'm not going to post what y'all want me to post on what Black people should be doing. Or, oh no, I'm not going to be over here and post in a conservative box and y'all say that Black people should pull themselves up by the bootstraps. I don't want to be in anybody's box. And I think the freedom of coming to understand who you are is most important to what you said, being at peace. And when you could be at peace, you really could do some things now, because I wasn't at peace at a lot of things. And I can tell you right now, That's why it's truly going to be wonderful going forward, because I'm a man who's at peace at who and what I'm called to be.
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to it. You got me excited now.
Yeah, man.
I just want to see what's going to happen.
Well, absolutely.
As I told you, an hour is going to run real quick.
Yeah, man. We already there, huh? Yeah, wow, we already there.
So, wow. Sonia Rorell and Anthony Ray both know that I'll be talking to you. So, you know, you got to give Dr. Johnson 2 hours.
Yes. Listen, they were my first interview when I was the president of Tuskegee, and I think that was interesting. Wow. Full circle, right?
This podcast was started based on an idea Anthony Ray and Sonia came up with.
Wow.
And if you recall, in 2014, when I wrote the white paper, that's when I first spoke to Anthony.
Wow.
And then when I wrote the book and the pandemic hit and I couldn't do the book tours, they suggested, why don't you do this podcast? So you, that's the power of what you said, relationship.
Wow. Yes.
But I want to ask you this question that I ask all my guests. I've asked Otis Moss Jr., Andrew Young, Dorothy Yancey, Claude Alexander.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to put your inspirational hat on, your presidential inspirational hat, your faith-based hat. We're in the midst of a pandemic, and you know, you're looking at people, remote work, you hear that ginning up now.
Yep.
Jobs, people having to change jobs, folks thinking that their lives will be at a different station than where it is currently.
Sure.
And there in some pockets is a sense of, like, I don't want to say hopelessness, but despair.
Sure.
Given all that you've shared today and your journey, what words of inspiration and hope, and I'm going to, in your instance, pastoral emphasis, would you share with our audience? Our audience is pretty much people who are young people, young professionals, and they might be looking at this thing and saying, I don't know which way I'm supposed to go. What would you say to them?
Wow. Well, you know, for me in my house, man, there's a scripture that says, Christ in you is your only hope of glory. And that just, for me and my perspective, the scriptures talk about, you know, Jesus saying, you know, in that day, it won't be like the kingdom of God is over there. Go run and find it on Twitter. The kingdom of God is within you. And again, you know, Paulo Sorrello, the book, The Alchemist. So if people, that's too much Christian. Well, let me give you the book, The Alchemist. The Alchemist, that book was all about you going the whole around the world and going to every place in the world, only to find that your treasure was right there where you began. And so for me, whatever it is that allows you to tap into the God man or the God woman that you were created to be, for me, that's Jesus Christ. But for you, it may be something else, but you got to turn and look within. And that is a hard labor, and it's a hard process, but it's a fruitful and rewarding one. And as things are revealed to you about who you are, you should step out boldly in those things, right? And so I would just have to say, I encourage you to really seek after God with all the whole heart and trust that that revelation of who he is and how he came to be seen and how he came to be known will become something that's intimate and personal to you so that you can be who he wants you to be, so that others can then see what it is to be at peace and at purpose and into their vision. And then you'll also be able to share the way in which you came to that knowledge. So that's about as purposeful and inspirational I could be, and I hope that touches somebody.
No, I mean, that is good. You know, one of the things I know the guests listen, the audience listening to this episode will come to understand your scholarly nature. You are well-read, read vociferously, and I used to follow your quotes, even though people didn't appreciate them, and your tipping and your daily, I used to read them, and I was like, wow, I need to internalize some of those things.
Yes.
So nobody appreciated them, my brother. I did.
Yeah.
Oh. And what I'd like to do to close us out is, I'll just leave it up to you. What would you like to share with your students, this audience, anything to close us out? We have about 3 minutes left.
Hey, I just want to share. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share. You know, I don't always, as you know, I don't always take opportunities to share. You know, most, you know, people have tried to push me to, you know, Drew, you'll be surprised. You know, there's a major article that's going to be done on me. Diverse Magazine, when I was on the cover, I didn't ask for that. I didn't ask to be on the cover of Montgomery Advertiser. Growing up, I didn't ask to be, you know, in this. I had a newspaper article when I was graduating, coming out of the inner city. They called it a young man apart. I've never been one to really ask because I'm, contrary to popular belief, I'm an introvert, right? I prefer to be alone and reading and meditating. That is my existence. When someone asked me to do something, that was a I had to step out. And so when you reached out, I normally would have came up with some excuse. I was like, I'm not doing that no more. I'm going to let people, and that's really, I'm just being honest with you. And you'll look back and you'll be like, oh, that's why he's that way. Cause I'm really an introvert. Like, you know, getting to a place or going somewhere to speak and be, that's one thing, but at my core, that's not where I lived. I lived. And so look, as far as quotes and things, that's where I live. So I quote a song or whatever. That's what I'm doing. I'm not doing that for y'all. I'm doing that for me. So I don't really care if a whole lot of people like it because that means you look, because if a whole lot of people like it, then I'm like a whole lot of people, and I'm unlike a whole lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I would just encourage, my final words would be to for people to just get on that journey, you know, get on that journey of calling. I think the journey of calling, I used to say the greatest 7-letter words in succession are passion, purpose, and calling. And because I think that's the whole of it, like, you know, that's the whole of your existence. Like, you all know, and no one has to tell you that you cannot be utterly fulfilled knowing you might make a lot of money. But if you call to do something with your gifts and your talents and you're not doing it, you going to be unsatisfied. Not me telling you, you're not going to be unsatisfied, but no, you already know. And you're in front of that camera and you're doing Twitter or MSNBC and you know you're not in your calling, but no, you want to keep your job. You want to do it, or you want to say something that's not authentic to your people, or you got to say something that's not authentic to your faith. That is a horrible existence to be in. Mm-hmm. The only existence to be in is to be uniquely who you call me to be. I'm not called to be a pastor. That's not what I'm called to be. But to be a president in the space of higher education, to be in this space, fulfilling that calling, that purpose is the greatest joy, regardless of how small the school is in comparison with the other schools I've been at. It's what I've been purposed to do. So I would just leave with the admonition for people to come to understand their purpose and their calling and to begin that work. And I'm always open if people want books to help towards that end. Look, we can start there. Or if you are a person of faith, then we can start with the Bible. If you're not in my faith, that's okay too, because we got people, you know, everybody's not of the faith, you know, that's fine. Here's a principle that will be useful, you know, in this book, and we can talk about the book. I'm willing to talk about all those kind of things, and that's really what's most important. But I would just say, just make sure you get on that journey to discovery of who you are, and that's the most important journey, the most valuable journey you could ever be on. That's what I would say.
Well, my brother, so well said, so well said. Yeah. Always profound, simple, but
yeah.
Profound.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, we've just spent an hour and 2 minutes with my good friend. I'm gonna be very formal here.
Yeah.
Dr. Brian DJ Johnson.
Yeah.
Good friend. I hope that you guys heard exactly what he was saying today and sharing. And I hope that some of his words, his journey, his story, some of the gravitas, if you will, around his journey and what he has accomplished, and him basically sharing his ups, his downs, and I'm going to call it his comeback, LL Cool J. He's been here for years. But ladies and gentlemen, it is my hope that this week's episode touched a nerve, tugged on a heartstring, and continue to give you that sense of viewing your life through a different lens. Dr. Brian Johnson was our guest this week, and I'm profoundly humbled that he took this time coming out of himself to come share with us on this program today. So until next week, remember, it's easy, son. Your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. Until next week, stay safe, stay strong, and be blessed.